I wondered if you paid any attention to this last song. Since I was not able to sing, I had time to consider the words. I believe one of the problems when you sing, you don't have time to really let the words soak in. And so while I just followed along, I noticed that the man that wrote this song was evidently a pre-trib premillennialist. Now look at that last verse and think about what I preached about here last Sunday night, Revelation 1 and 4, about the door being opened in heaven. Now look at what this man said. In garments glorious he will come to open wide the door. What door is he talking about? The door in heaven. That's the only door Christ is going to open. And I shall enter my heavenly home. In other words, when he comes back and he opens the door into heaven, he's going back with him to dwell forevermore. So I'd say that that man was a pretty good scholar out of the Scriptures. When I first saw that song, Out of the Ivory Palaces, many years ago, I thought it was one of the most unscriptural songs I'd ever seen in the world, and I was ready to put it in the garbage can. But after I studied the psalm over there that it's based on, and saw all these glorious revelations about Christ that's in it, and saw how well this man brought them all out, I thought it was a masterpiece after that. And tonight I noticed that last verse is a greater masterpiece than all the others when you think about what the man said, because he said what the Bible said in Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. He just put it in the words of the psalm. Now, I'm going to read that first verse of chapter 4 because we're going to try to look at 2 and 3 tonight. We won't get down probably to the 24 elders because I'll spend a lot of time on those. They're mentioned a number of times later in the book. If you don't understand who they are, then you're not going to know what they're talking about every time they're mentioned. But we won't talk about those tonight. Anyway, you can be thinking about them. Now, I'm going to read that verse, and you think about the words of the song there. After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was, as it were, a trumpet talking with me, which said, Come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. So I really believe that man described those words there clearly. Now we get down to verse 2. We see the throne and the throne sitter. There are other visions of God in the Bible. Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and others saw visions of the throne of God. And some in the book of Ezekiel we're going to look at because they sound a lot like the description here that John gives in Revelation chapter 4 that we'll be studying. Now let's read that second verse. And immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, the throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. It doesn't tell us a whole lot about the throne sitter, but it does say that it's occupied. Somebody's sitting on it. And the way that it reads, there's only one person. One sat on the throne. We'll make quite a bit to do about that as we go along. What did John mean, though, when he said, And immediately I was in the Spirit? Well, what happened to John spiritually here in the vision of the Revelation is what's going to happen to all the saints at the rapture, because we are immediately going to be caught up to heaven. Now, think about how that'll all be, what, in the twinkling of an eye, as one man put it. Think of the words of the Apostle Paul over here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 when he talks about the rapture. He said, we'll not all sleep, but we'll all be changed. He said, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. John talked about a trumpet over there, trumpet-like voice. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. And over here he said, and immediately I was in the Spirit. The word Spirit there is not capitalized. It could be that John was just caught up into heaven in his Spirit. Or it could be that the whole John was caught up into heaven by the Holy Spirit of God. Which way it was is really not all that important. Because either way he saw this great revelation of the end time. And after all, it was a communication primarily to his spirit. Because the body and all of that would not have been very well equipped to take care of this knowledge. So in the twinkling of an eye, John is in heaven. And I believe, like I said, a type there of the raptured saints. And John begins to describe the heavenly tabernacle. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 1 to 6, as well as verse 24, tells us that the earthly tabernacle was typical of the heavenly tabernacle. In other words, one of them corresponded to the other, not in every detail, but they were a lot alike. And so this tabernacle of God that was upon earth during the days of Moses in the tent, and later on they built it and put it in a temple, it was all a type of heaven. So, well, it's a type of Christ, yes, but it was a type of heaven. Because what we're seeing here is the heavenly tabernacle. Now, this statement, I was in the Spirit, like I said, you can understand that different ways. Look back over here in chapter 1 in verse 10. And I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. Now, I'm just going to show you how it occurs different times in the book. Chapter 17, verse 3, what do we find him saying there? And so he carried me away in the Spirit into the wilderness. And then right over toward the end of the book in chapter 21 in verse 10, and he carried me away in the Spirit. And, of course, that's when he went up to see the New Jerusalem. Went up into a high mountain, very much like the devil carried Christ up into a high mountain we talked about here this morning. However, those who know the original language far better than I do, J.A. Cease and others, and certainly he's a scholar that don't need a whole lot of vindication, because if you've ever read him, you know that he's got a mind that's almost unexcelled. I don't think I've ever seen a fellow that seemed to have so much knowledge just in one head. But you note even our version indicates it pretty plain there. Behold, a throne was set in heaven. Actually, the idea that this throne was set up. It was set up. Brother Cease says that the Greek implies that the throne was being set up and then somebody came after that and sat down on the throne. Now, it's all a vision that John's seeing, but that's what he's seeing there. So it means that his throne was being set up as John looked upon it. So the vision includes not only the placing of a throne, but the throne itself and the throne sitter. All right, now let's think about another passage in the Old Testament. Thrones being set up. Go back to the book of Daniel. And look at what Daniel has to tell us. Chapter 7, verse 9 and 10. And again, our version does not have proper translation of the Hebrew here. Verse 9, I'm going to read it like it has the word cast down, but that's not what it is in the Hebrew. I beheld till the thrones were set up. That's literally what the Hebrew says. If you cast them down, in a sense, they're being set up. But in other words, they were erected. That's what he's talking about. They were being established at the time he saw the vision. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit. There's the throne and the throne sitter. Whose garments was white as snow, and the hair of his head like unto pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, and the judgment was set, and the books were opened. We won't go into that. That's not our topic. I just wanted you to know that in Daniel 9, and rather 7 and verse 9, it talks about thrones being set up. That's exactly what we have here in Revelation chapter 4 and verse 2. Thrones are, a throne is being set up. He just sees one being set up at this time. Later, he's going to see 24 men that'll be sitting on the throne. Have you ever thought about how that the book of Revelation is a throne book of the Bible? How many times do you believe that the word throne is mentioned in the book of Revelation? Would you believe 45 times? How many times is it mentioned in the rest of the New Testament? 15. So when I call Revelation the throne book of the Bible, I'm not exaggerating. I'm saying exactly what the Bible says. It's mentioned 45 times in this book. So then it's a throne room book. Now, like I said, there's only one person sitting on this throne. The throne is in heaven. Now, I assume it's the third heaven where God's government is. I don't believe it's the second heaven or the first. I believe it's up in the third heaven. Now, is this the same throne that we read about over here in chapter 3 and verse 21 where it says that Christ and the Father are sitting on a throne? It can't be. First of all, that throne back over there was one that was the eternal throne of God. This throne here is being set up, being established at the time John saw it. Remarkable thing about the throne in Revelation 4 and 2, there's only one fellow that sits on the throne. All right, somebody said, now if you just got one on it, then Christ is not there. That's right, he's not there. He's somewhere else, but he's not on the throne with the Father here. Now let's compare some of this. Well, I think I'll wait later to go to there to the book of Ezekiel. And it says, one sat on the throne. Now we need to know, who is this person that's sitting on the throne? A lot of people, even one writer says it's the judgment seat of Christ, and Christ is sitting on this throne. No, I don't think so. Not if you read chapter 5 in connection with chapter 4. I don't see how you can come up with that conclusion. That's really a stretch of the imagination to me. All right, let's see if the Bible won't identify this throne sitter. Go over to chapter 5 and verse 13. And he's clearly distinguished from the Lord Jesus Christ. Over there you have all the creatures in heaven and on earth and under the earth saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be unto him that sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. So the throne sitter is not the Lamb, it's God the Father. Clearly indicated there. Now look, chapter 7, verse 10 of the same book of Revelation talks about the great multitude in heaven of all kindreds of the earth and says, stood before the throne and before the Lamb. Again, it's implied there would be a person on the throne and the Lamb is near to the throne. Actually, he's going to be standing out in front of it. A little later we're going to see in the book here. And then over in chapter 19, I'm showing you that the throne sitter is none other than God the Father. Chapter 19 and verse 4. And the 24 elders and four beasts fell down and worshiped God that sat on the throne. Again, it's singular. There's only one person on this throne. It's God the Father. Somebody said, well, what is this throne? Well, it's a very temporary throne that is set up for the 7-year tribulation period. Now, later on, after the millennium, there's going to be another very special throne set up out in space called the Great White Throne. There's a lot of different thrones of God in the Bible, especially in prophecy and all of that. You might as well bring yourself to see that. It will be from this throne and from God that sits upon this throne that the opening of the seals, the blowing of the trumpets, and the outpouring of the bowls of wrath will all take place. In other words, this is God's judgment throne. It doesn't say a thing in the world about being a throne of grace. The throne that the Lord is on now is a throne of grace. But this is not a throne of grace. This is a throne of judgment and justice. And it is not the throne in Revelation 3:21, nor is it the throne that is ordinarily mentioned so many times in the Bible. John saw this throne being set up as the tribulation period is getting ready to start. So I'd call it the tribulation throne. You can call it whatever you want to. Now let's go on and look at the next verse that follows there. And he doesn't tell us the form of the one that sits on it, but he tells us what he looks like. In other words, what it appears like. The outward brilliancy and all of that of the throne sitter. And he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone. He didn't say now that he was a sardine stone and a jasper. Said, if you look upon him, it has that appearance. And there was a rainbow round about the throne in the sight like unto an emerald. A lot of things here. Why didn't John see the actual shape of the throne sitter? Because God the Father does not have any shape that the human eye can see. That's why you can't make any likeness to God. What did Jesus say about the Father over here in John chapter 5 and verse 37? Ye have neither heard his voice at any time, nor seen his shape. Now, if you do see the shape of God, as we'll learn in a few moments in the book of Ezekiel, he looks like a man. Remember that man was made in the image of God. There has to be a little natural likeness there. After you can argue about all the other points, still you come back to the idea, if God does not in his form, and God has a form, because Philippians talks about the form of God, but he didn't see any form of God here because he's seeing God the Father. Now, if he saw Christ the Son, he would see him in the form of a man. And so that means most of the time when they saw the Lord on the throne and he looked like a man, they were probably seeing Christ instead of the Father. Now, let's go back over here and compare Ezekiel's vision of the throne of God in heaven with the one that John mentions here. And you'll note that there's a throne and a throne sitter, and there's a rainbow. Though the description is a little bit different. Go back to Ezekiel chapter 1 and look at verse 26. And above the firmament, there was over the over their heads was a likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. Little difference here. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness and the appearance of a man above upon it. And I saw as the colors of amber, as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loin even downward, I saw as it were the appearance of fire. This is a judgment throne too. It's got fire, the wrath of God's here. And it had brightness round about. And as the appearance of the bowl, and we call it the rainbow most of the time, that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. So it's got a man on the throne, at least somebody looks like a man. It's a very bright throne, it dazzles the eyes. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. That's exactly what John saw, the glory of the Lord, too. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. And on we could go there. But John does not, in his vision, see any shape, because he's seeing God the Father that has no particular shape that man can see with the eye. So what he saw was the brilliance and glory of God the Father. And that was a spectacular thing to behold. Now I know that a lot of people say, well, he mentions here the jasper stone, and don't you know that the jasper stone, at least I've seen a lot of different colors. Some of them I think are said to be blue, and some of them are said to be green and all of that. Definitely the jasper stone in the Bible doesn't look like any of these. It's a clear stone like a diamond. You say, well, how do you know? Well, what the Bible says about it. Look over here in Revelation 21 and verse 11. It talks about it and gives a description of it. Talking about the holy city having the glory of God, and their light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. That's a clear stone like a diamond then. It doesn't have any color of any kind. And so we don't need to argue about whether it was blue or green or some other color. It wasn't any color. It was clear. It was crystal clear. That's what it was. So it didn't have the emerald green color that some have supposed. It just simply was not there. But it's like a diamond. Now, what did that symbolize? That symbolized the crystal purity or holiness of God. In other words, God is light and there is no darkness in him. Then he talked about it being like a sardine stone. Well, anybody that is familiar with the sardine stone, very commonly used in trade and a lot of stuff in the times of John, it was a ruby red stone-like. As a matter of fact, it was not a good ruby red. It almost was the color of flesh. Some of them were, from what I read. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. Remember now that in Ezekiel's vision, he saw this fire. What color is fire? Sort of red. So then there is a parallel between Ezekiel's vision and John's vision, because Ezekiel saw God in all of his wrath. And so what John is seeing here is God the Father, who is getting ready to pour out his wrath on this earth. He's seeing an angry God. He's not seeing a God of love and grace so much as a God of judgment and justice. We've oftentimes said what we need is mercy. That's true. But during the tribulation period, people are not going to get a whole lot of mercy. They're going to get a lot of judgment and justice. A lot of times, you know, people look around at the world today and see it's in an awful mess. And why don't God do something? I tell you what, if you'll read the book of Revelation and see what he's going to do during that 7-year tribulation period, you'll decide he is going to do something. He done something during the plagues of Egypt, and he's going to do something during the time of the great tribulation that'll take place here upon the earth. So I think that denotes the wrath of God. I think about over there in the connection with Gog, Ezekiel 38 and verse 18 said, "My fury has come up before my face." As if to say, I'm as mad as I can be, I'm red in the face from a human standpoint. So what we're seeing here is a God that is angry, that is about to take out his judgments on the earth. You say, well, what else can you tell me about these stones? They were in the breastplate of the high priest. You go over there in Exodus 28, 17 to 21, and you'll find they were there. The jasper was the last stone in the breastplate of the high priest, and the sardine stone was the first. What significance that may have, I'm not sure. Now, if you go over here to the description of the holy city, look in Revelation chapter 21, verse 19 and 20. "And the foundations of the wall of the city was garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper." So jasper is the first stone mentioned in the foundation of New Jerusalem. "The second, sapphire. The third, chalcedony. The fourth, an emerald. The fifth, sardonyx. The sixth, sardius. The seventh, chrysolite. The eighth, beryl. The ninth, the topaz. The tenth, chrysophorus. The 11th, the jacinth. The 12th, an amethyst." He goes on there. You notice that the jasper is first in the list and the sardine is the sixth in the list. What significance this may have, I cannot say. I just merely observe that in the description that is given here in the Bible. But then he talks about a rainbow around this throne. And there seems to be a rainbow also over there in the book of Ezekiel. But I believe probably Brother Larkins and others is right in saying that the difference is that the rainbow we see is a semicircle. In other words, it's a half rainbow, half circle. And the rainbow around the throne of God is a complete circle. It goes all the way around. One writer commented, and he may be right. He said, down here on earth, said we see just about half of what God really knows. And so that's about all we need to see is half of a rainbow. And probably true. Let's go back and look at the first mention of the rainbow in the Bible. It goes back to the Noahic Covenant. Go back over there. And we want to read in the book of Genesis, beginning at chapter 9 at verse 13, and go down just a little ways there. "And I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a token of a covenant between me and the earth." So the rainbow is symbolic. It is the outward symbol of God's covenant with Noah. Plainly stated there. "And it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant." So the rainbow reminds God and reminds us of the Noahic covenant. Should. "Which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh." Now the Noahic covenant was a little bit different from some of the others because it was not only made with all mankind in a sense, but it was also made with the beasts of the field. With the earth. That's what it said right there. "And the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh," which implies, except for Noah and his family and sons, that all flesh perished on the earth. "And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it, and I will remember the everlasting covenant between God and all every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth." So God looks at that rainbow and it makes him remember his covenant. And we ought to look upon it and remember his covenant. "And God said unto Noah, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth." So then the rainbow is first mentioned in Genesis chapter 9 as a symbol of the Noahic covenant. And if you go back and you read in chapter 8, you'll find that it was a sign of the Noahic covenant that mercy was founded upon an acceptable sacrifice. And that was a very important truth, that God's mercy is always given to us on the basis of an acceptable sacrifice. Remember that sacrifice Noah made? Didn't have many animals either, but he made a sacrifice, and God was well pleased with it. Very important truth there. Well, somebody said, why do you have the rainbow up there around the throne of God? Because the God that sits on that throne is a covenant-keeping God. He don't lie in His promise. He means what He says. And every time that I see a rainbow, I'm reminded that God means what He says, that He keeps His covenant. Now, remember there was a rainbow over there in Ezekiel. We read about that, but the difference is that the rainbow we see is a semicircle. It has seven primary colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. It has the seven primary colors there. But the rainbow that John and Ezekiel saw was a complete circle, and it was jasper in color. It didn't have all these seven colors that our rainbows have. Because he very plainly says there, a rainbow round about the throne in sight like unto an emerald. It was like unto an emerald. Why in the world would this be mentioned? Is the rainbow mentioned any other place in the Bible? Yes. It's mentioned over here in the book of Revelation in chapter 10 and verse 1. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. And his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as the pillars of fire. So, it is mentioned again. We'll talk about that later. Why did John see, first of all, a throne of judgment? And then, after seeing this throne of an angry God, he saw a complete rainbow. Because a God that is going to deal with the earth in wrath is also going to commingle that with mercy. And so God will, in wrath, remember mercy, as Habakkuk 3 and 3 tells us that He will. So the terrible tribulation storm is about to come from that throne, just like the terrible flood came from that throne, in a sense, back in the days of Noah. But in the midst of all of that judgment, there's also going to be a remembrance of mercy. Some people will be saved, some will survive. Now then, let's think about these three stones. There are three stones in that last verse. You have the Trinity there, in a sense, in those three stones. A great Puritan back in 1600 named Cotton. I believe his name was John Cotton, if I remember. He said, here is the Trinity, if you'll look carefully. He said, the jasper is God the Father. He said, the sardine stone is red or fleshly color. He said, that's Christ that became a man and shed His blood. And said, the emerald represents the Holy Spirit. That's not a new interpretation. That's what John Cotton said back in 1600. It's not a new interpretation. It's a very old one, and probably a very good one, very suggestive. Well, my voice is about gone, and so it's going to be short. But now you study on that 24 elders, because that's one of the keys to the book, is understanding who these are. And why would they be called elders? Why not be called angels or called men or something like that? And why do they sit on thrones? And why do they wear crowns and all this kind of stuff? Well, we'll talk about that, God willing, next Sunday night. You'll have quite a bit to go home and think about tonight. Let us stand and we'll sing.